My name is Rick Cheddar, and this is From Radioland.
So it was March of 1997. I walked into 203 Beale Street. It was where the radio station was, where Rock 103 was. It was shared with two other stations. It was WREC 600 AM, the news talk station, and then there was another third station that was there at the time whose call letters escaped me right off the bat because it had changed hands several times, and one of them was the X, and at one point, it right before everything really went down, it was WOTO, only the oldies, of which I actually got to spend a little time jocking in a little bit later on, but I digress already. So it was that day in March. It was a Wednesday, and I took a tape that I had fabricated, of which you've heard about in the previous episode, of my abilities as a radio personality, and I took it in, understanding that they were possibly looking for a part-time jock. So I went in there and dropped it off and filled out the obligatory employment application. And on Thursday, I got a phone call from Drake Hall. He was the program director at the time. And he invited me to come to the station on Friday for an interview, of which I did, and had a laugh, had some fun. By that very next day on Saturday, I was on the air. I was training under a cat by the name of Wes Yahola, who is currently Drake's producer with Drake and Zeke over at 98. And I'll go back at some point. I'll try and relay a lot of, you know, what has happened to a lot of these guys. But I'm just painting the picture from what it was like in 1997 and up forward a bit, because Clear Channel, of course, had been in power of the cluster there. And you have to remember that there were a total of six stations that were owned by Clear Channel here in the Memphis market. There was those three that I mentioned there on Beale Street, which was kind of a funny spot because we were right upstairs from Alfred's. If you're familiar with Beale Street, right across the street from Handy Park. It was a neat kind of a magical little spot because everything that was happening down there at that time was all right there on Beale Street. And anytime we were, you know, something was, you know, an event of some sort that was unfolding, we were right there in the thick of it. And my first job at the time was doing Saturday nights, 6 to midnight, which I held for many years there. No matter what I did, I still maintained that. And included in that was a 9 o'clock bit called Get the Lead Out. A lot of you might remember that, where we played nothing but Led Zeppelin at 9 o'clock for about 40, 45 minutes. And it was really the taste that I would have of like real freeform radio, which was a blast at the time. And while I was doing all of that, working part-time, so I was doing the Saturday night, 6 to midnight, I also had to do this other thing to make the quota. I did Sunday mornings, 6 a.m. to noon. So I had this really weird swing shift right in there, and it, you know, it wrecked many a Saturday night and, quite frankly, many a Sunday morning that I don't recall ever really being a part of, but I was told I was there and had some fun doing it. One of the things that I did, what I'd have to do, was babysit a CD program called Flashback with Bill St. James as the host, and it would come in on these four discs, and, you know, we had three CD players in the room. And at the time that I had come there, there was no real computer system in play. So all the commercials had to be played on what was called a cart system. And it looks like an 8-track tape, if you'll remember those cartridges. And then we'd have a bunch of them. And they were in this carousel that were on the wall or on the floor near the end of the counter. And they were all categorized by number and name. And we would have to, you know, follow the log, and we'd pull them in. And we had eight of these machines, and each one, of course, held one of the carts. And you'd load them in there, and when the cart played, it would trip the next one, and so on and so forth. So away it went. So you had to kind of juggle all of the cart machines at the same time, and then you had the three CD players plus several room mics. What it boiled down to was that there was not any given second where you couldn't turn your back on the board unless you had a long enough song to perhaps run down the hall to go to the bathroom or get another cup of coffee or step out for a quick smoke or something like that. But of course, back in those days, we used to smoke in the studio, so it made things a lot easier on everybody, and it kept the tensions on down. Now, when I did the Saturday night thing, of course, that was a blast. I got a nice touch as to just how weird you people really are, and having to deal with some of the bizarre phone calls that occurred after 10 p.m. And then the Sunday morning stuff was quite strange because it was a completely different audience, and it was made up of people who didn't really give a shit about the music or about the people that were there. I mean, I did the Flashback show was 4 hours. That gave me another 2 hours from 10 a.m. to noon to kind of follow the log, if you will, and jock for a little bit. And then I'd have to stay on until my relief came in there, and I couldn't leave until he got there, and there were several times when A, he was drunk or late, or whoever it was supposed to be just didn't show up, and I wound up having to stay on. I think my longest stint in that control room was probably 18 hours, just stuck in there. And trust me, if you want to know why I've lost a lot of my marbles, it was stuff like that happened, because I'm a tad bit claustrophobic, but I feel very comfortable in small confined studio type settings because of, you know, that it's the way out. The microphone was always that bit of solace to me, and that was a good thing. So as time went on, and I proved myself as best as I could to the powers that be doing the weekend thing, I wound up spending some time learning the art of digital audio editing. Now, I could cut tape with a razor blade and scotch tape all day long, and obviously those days were coming behind us, because the first computers that actually came into the business was in our production studio. And in there, we had this PC, and we used a fairly simple editing program, of which I'm using right now, which is how this show is recorded. It's called Cool Edit Pro. It was put out by the Centrillium Corporation. And it was a wonderful little program all the way up until Adobe got a hold of it and just screwed it all up. And don't buy it. If you're going to go into the audio business, get Pro Tools. But at any rate, I digress. Cool Edit was the thing. And the production director at the time was a guy by the name of Rick Robinson. And Rick had been there for many years. And he would produce a lot of the bits for the morning show, which was at that time the Wake Up Crew, featuring Tim, Bev, and Bad Dog. It was Tim Spencer, Bev Hart, and John Bad Dog McCormack. Now, you need to know those names, because I'm going to refer to them in a little bit later on, because they all had very very interesting roles in my career. Now, as I was studying the audio editing system, I found myself to be quite comfortable with it. And as I came along and enjoying that, I would usually find myself there into the afternoons during the week, where Drake and Zeke were doing their afternoon show. And it started originally at 2 p.m., went till 6 p.m., and then they moved to 3 to 7. For whatever marketing reason, I don't know, but that's what they did. And I would spend 2 to 3 days a week producing them. And I would oftentimes screen calls. I'd record the show for them to have other bits that they might need down the way. And a lot of times they would come up with comedic bits that needed some type of audio support, of which I would go into the production studio and create it based off of what Drake would tell me. Like, he would say he would need a particular sound, and I would either have to fabricate it or dig it out of a library of some sort, and put it all together for these guys to use. And it wasn't really hard work at all. In fact, it was quite enjoyable, because it allowed me to turn the production studio into, at least in my head, and instead of a place just to lay down sound and piece something together, what it was it was a studio where you could have, in essence, a lump of clay and turn it into whatever it is that you wanted. If you could imagine it, I could create it in audio, and I felt very comfortable with it. And not to blow my own horn here, but I got good at it. And, well, that is kind of important to know, because one day I was called into the office, into the operations manager's office. That would be Tim Spencer. And Tim worked under the general manager of the cluster. Her name was Sherry Sawyer. And I was then promoted on the spot to be the production director for the cluster there on Beale Street. Now, keep in mind, there were three other stations I mentioned earlier. There was what we used to call the urban stations, and they were all helmed by a man by the name of Bruce Demps. They were on Union Avenue at the time, and in a very old building there. There was the great station WDIA, which, of course, is still on the air. There's K97, and then there's V101. And they were, as the name implied, an urban station, meaning they catered primarily to a black audience. And they had everything from blues and soul music to some of the more modern contemporary soul, and then into a hip-hop station, which was remarkably successful in this market, still is. And there was the two separate properties with two separate general managers. And I mentioned Sherry because Sherry was very instrumental in my career. Sherry, as the GM, you'd have to imagine her. Those of you who knew her that are listening to this would know exactly what I'm talking about because of this description I'm about to lay on you. But you have to keep in mind that she probably barely broke 5 feet high wearing shoes. She was a blonde woman who had a very, very strong fortitude about her. She didn't put up with any bullshit, but she also had a very big sense of humor and a very large heart. And she, as no nonsense as she is, she was very intimidating. And I had been working there for probably 4 months before I finally met her. And I was over in the, where the mail area is. And I had a box that had production orders and stuff like that in there. And I went in and I was checking the mail, and Sherry's secretary was out in the hallway, and she knew who I was because she had to deal with my paperwork and all. And she said, "Have you met Sherry yet?" And I said, "No, I haven't." And she goes, "Well, go on in. She's in there." So the way her office was set up is that there was this outer office, which is the secretary's office, which had its own door. And then you would walk through it, and that door would lead into this bigger office. It was very nice. It was well-appointed. Typical radio station fare. I mean, it wasn't overly corporate. It had a nice bookshelf in it, I recall, and nice carpeting on the wall, sort of this wood paneling, kind of neatly lamp-lit, not overhead, none of the buzzing fluorescence and stuff. And it had a window that overlooked Beale Street. It actually led to a balcony in the sliding glass window, and out there she had a barbecue grill. And I remember seeing that offhand right out of the chute going, "Hey, this chick's all right. You know, she's got this kind of thing going on." So I walk in there, and she's got her head down in the books and she's working on something, and I'm standing there, and I had just come in off the street. Of course, there was no dress code at the radio station. So I showed up, and at the time I was driving a convertible, and it had been quite warm out there, and I had significantly shorter hair, and it was a lot blonder than it is now. And I was standing there in this ratty pair of shorts, tennis shoes, no socks, and I was kind of barely wearing a Hawaiian shirt, and I had a Diet Coke in my hand. And I walked in there, and I said, "Excuse me." And she looked up, and I think I still had my sunglasses on, which were mirrored, of course, because I was that big of a douchebag back then. And she... And back then, I didn't have the mustache I have now. I had that more of that 70s porn thing going, you know, corner to corner lip thing. It was thick as hell, and it was its own personality. So I'm standing there, and she looks at me like I had just screwed her cat, and she said, "Who are you?" And I walked over to her desk, terrified of this little woman, and I stuck my hand out over the top of her desk, and she shook my hand, and I said, I'm Rick. I work for you now." And I thought right when I said that, when those words came out of my face, that I had just probably said the worst things ever in that, is that I work for you. And here I was looking like a complete idiot. And she took her glasses off, and she leaned back, and she was trying to take me in, and she kind of smiled, and she goes, "Yeah, I kind of figured as much. I remember seeing your paperwork that came through here. Welcome aboard. Basic rule of thumb here is do as you're told and don't fuck anything up." And those are the sort of the parameters of which I run Radio Memphis by, and it's the two rules. The first one is to have fun, and the second rule is to don't fuck anything up. And I know that if you follow the first rule a lot, the second rule is just naturally going to get broken. And these things happen, and that's why if that happens, I'm not going to run you off. But if you're not having fun, there's nothing I can do about that. But say, "Hey, there's the door. Thanks for the good times and the laughs, and take a light bleed." But Sherry and I, I guess, sort of had a rocky start. But I guess that's the way she treated everybody. And here's the thing, before I go on too much further about Sherry. Sherry was not liked by a lot of people. I don't know why. I never understood it. I love the woman. I thought she was tremendous. She had bigger balls than a lot of the guys that are in this business. And I watched her go through a very difficult part in her life, where the corporation really fucked her over and really did a lot of damage to her. Sherry had been a lifelong survivor and constant battler, if you will, a warrior of cancer. She had some form of Hodgkin's disease. I don't know. I don't recall which one. But it would spread from time to time, and she would have to undergo different procedures, and it was slowly tearing her apart. At one point, while we were on Beale, Clear Channel had decided that it was best to combine all six stations under one roof. And the logical step was to have Bruce Demps come over as the GM at the time, and Sherry was on her way out. And she wound up working for a cluster in, I believe, Raleigh, North Carolina, Raleigh-Durham area. And ultimately, that didn't pan out. She came back to Memphis and was working at WXMX. It was the Cumulus stations that are here, which is where Drake and Zeke are at now, which is how they wound up over there. I'll get to that in a minute. I know I seem to be jumping around, but bear with me on this. Ultimately, Sherry died. She lost her fight with cancer, and it was a big deal. The funeral was a big procession, and there was a lot of folks that went. I included. I had to pay my respects to such things. I normally don't go to other people's funerals unless I really knew them or if I felt as though they were family. I've been asked to go to other people's funerals and I didn't know them, and I just doesn't feel right to me. So, but that one I actually had to go to. And the cancer thing was pretty bad. She worked all the way up to the point where she had to go into a wheelchair, and she continued to work at Cumulus during all that time. And ultimately they came to her and said that it was time for her to go home and to enter hospice and close that chapter of her life, which was, I guess, the final book on it. Sherry and I and John and everybody else, we were all pretty tight. And she was a, you know, like I said, a very funny lady. She didn't put up with too much nonsense, and she knew how to run a radio station very well with a very dry wit and no aspirations of being involved in the showbiz end of it. She was actually more into the business end of it, which is what makes a good general manager, somebody that understands that, you know, you got to keep the doors open, you got to keep the lights on, and you got to keep your people fed. And through that time, as I'm going to go back a little bit, I became the production director. I stepped into the production studio, and Rick Robinson was in there, unbeknownst to me. He was in there cleaning his stuff out, and I thought that that already been taken care of. They'd told me that they'd let him go and that I was replacing him, and they were making me full-time. And I walked in there, and I saw him, and he looked a little... well, as any guy would be in that position, pissed off and, you know, a little hurt by it. And I stopped, and I felt as though I just encroached on a very private moment of him gathering his things out of there. And I said to him, look, I'm sorry. I didn't think you were in here. And he goes, no, that's okay. And he packed up his stuff and wasn't very kind to me, as I recall, at that point. Before then, yeah, he was very nice. He taught me a great number of things, and I thanked him for that. And I said, I appreciate you teaching me all of the things that I've learned from you. And he said, yes, it looks as though I just taught somebody how to replace me. You don't quite know how to take that sort of thing, but, you know, you just deal with it. I excused myself from the studio. I went downstairs. I went to get a bite to eat. I came back about an hour later, and his stuff was gone. And he had left a small note, and all it said was, enjoy the grapes of wrath. Suspended above the producer's chair in that room was this set, and I still have them. It's this set of rubber grapes that were stuck to the ceiling, and they'd been there for many, many years. And I guess it was sort of a tradition to pass them down. I'm going forward in time, but I took them with me because there was no other production director that followed me when I left. I'll get to that later, probably more like part three. So as I was working as the production director, I started to kind of take command of it, and I felt very comfortable with the job. Most of what I had to do was produce radio commercials, of which I've been on countless radio spots. I was the voice for Murdoch's Nissan for many years. Very interesting story about that client. It was run through an agency, and they would send me the copy via fax, you know, back when fax machines were a thing. And I would get paid a fee to cut the commercials, and they would run on just about every station in the city. And I can tell the story now because all those that are involved in this, first of all, Murdoch's Nissan is no longer in business, but I don't even think the agency's still around, and I'm sure this woman that was there, and I can't remember her name or I'd out her, but she would send this copy over to me, and I would record it. I think I've told this story before on this podcast, but those of you who are new are going to get it again. And it would come out on this cassette, right? And it was my voice, and it was like what they called a donut. So it had a jingle front, this music bed in the middle, and a jingle on the tail end of it. So it all sounded like really professional and stuff. And you just had to time your copy to make it work. And of course, I edited it all digitally, and I have to dump it down to a cassette because nobody in their right mind understood how an MP3 could possibly be emailed. I mean, this was a, you know, pretty cutting edge times now that I think about it. But I would play it back over the phone, and we had the special phone line where I could flip a switch and I could dump audio through the phone line so this woman could hear it. And she said, and I have to do these spots on average about once a month. sometimes twice a month, depending if there were copy changes. And invariably, the woman would hate the first read. She never liked what I did. So she would say, hey, listen, go back into the studio and emphasize this word, take this word and do this with it, lower the music, raise the music, whatever her complaint was. She always found something for that first cut. So I go back in and I do the second take of it. And I'd play that back, and she would bitch about that one as well. She didn't like it. There was a problem with it. The music was too loud. Music was too soft. Didn't like the emphasis on that, whatever. She was just, at this point I figured it out. She was just jerking my chain. I said, all right, give me about 20 minutes and I'll call you back with the third take on it, of which I did. And it was actually a replay of the first take that she didn't like originally. And she would say, great, that's the one. That's the keeper. Dub it and send it out, of which that's what I did. Because people will just they like to push you around in this. Something else that was really quite amusing about doing all of these commercials is that usually Fridays were the worst days of the week. That was the day, most people hate their Mondays, but Mondays in radio are actually quite light and quite easy to get through. Friday is when things get a little hairy. That's when all the production orders come in for the next week and all the stuff for the weekend that has to come out. And a lot of times it'll be all this stuff that would have to drop in for a Saturday or a Sunday, or start on Monday, and the copy wouldn't be in. The salesperson would have missed their deadline completely, and I'm sitting there with a stack of 50, 60 spots I've yet to cut, yet to dub, yet to edit, yet to do any of that stuff. I was looking at being there till midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, and this girl would come in there, and she would say, look, I really need to get this on, and it has to happen right now. And I would often say, you missed the deadline, sister. I can't get it through there. It may be on the log, but you didn't get the production order in time for me to actually do the job. So this is where I learned a very important lesson about the business, that salespeople carry around a lot of cash. At least they did back then. And this girl reached into her purse and she put a $100 bill and paperclipped it to the production order and said, will this help? And I said, yep, it sure will. So I made a couple extra bucks doing that. And I didn't take any qualms of it, because salespeople in this business are whores. That's all they do. That's what they do for a living. They sell themselves through the radio station. I've had salespeople that I've dealt with that would go into a particular client's office and they would try and sell a bit, and they would say, no, we're not going to buy it. And then they would turn around and say, well, would you like some dope instead? That kind of stuff. So there was, saleswomen blowing guys for clients, and it was crazy. And it was a lot of that was out there. Also, my job, though, not only as being the production director, was to be the full-time producer for the Drake and Zeke show afternoons at Rock 103. And getting a chance to spend about 8 years working with them was first of all, a big learning experience. Second of all, it was really good for the reflexes, because when Drake got pissed off and he threw something at you, you knew how to duck, and you had to duck quickly. We had a lot of fun in there. It was a great show. We had a lot of benchmark bits. We probably had two an hour that fell at different times, and they always had some type of an open or a close or some type of a sound effect or some bit that I would produce invariably that they would use. And so it was. That was my lot. I was going to be the production director, and I was going to be the producer for Drake and Zeke, and I still did my weekend stuff, and that was that. Then one day, Sherry leaves, much to the dismay of many people that were there at the building. And Bruce Demps comes in. Now, Bruce is the physical embodiment of Darth Vader. And I mean that in a good way. He's a big fella. He's 6'5", 6'6", black gentleman, knows how to wear a suit, very smart, not a micromanagement kind of guy. I felt, well, okay, this will be just fine. The step involved with Bruce was to start consolidation of all six radio stations, and that would mean that the six stations would leave Union Avenue and Beale Street, and they would put us in this place called Thousand Oaks, which is out by Perkins and American Way. Those of you familiar with Memphis know what I'm talking about. It was FedEx's original offices out there. It's corporate hell is what it is. 2650 Thousand Oaks was the address. We were up on the fourth floor. We had a horseshoe-shaped facility. It was enormous. And much to my dismay, as I learned when that why they were spending $40,000 a month for rent was beyond me, but that's the way they did it. Along the way, while this consolidation was happening, and it was going to take several years for that to come to play, there was this whole talk of bringing a computer system in that would run the actual radio station cluster. It was a system called NextGen, N-E-X-G-E-N, also known as Prophet, as in a seer, P-R-O-P-H-E-T. I was put on an airplane, and I was sent to Denver, Colorado for a week of learning how this system operates. I came back after a week. A buddy of mine had picked me up from the airport, and he and I went over to Alex's Tavern, the great Alex's Tavern. And when I was there, Drake was there, kind of hammered. And he said, what was it like? What is this thing? And I sat there and I told him this. I said, you've been in the business far longer than I have, and you've seen a lot of changes. You have seen, and as have I, the death of the LP record, the 45. We'd moved everything onto these cart things that we were talking about. Sometimes we were playing music off of it. We've seen the death of that. We saw the CD come, and now we have seen it go. And the compact disc is gone, and it's being replaced by an audio file that'll be replayed by a computer. A computer system, by the way, the owners said, does not require nor request human interference. Your job is to start it and stop it, and that is it. Those of you in production will learn how to stick stuff in it, but that's about it. Now, granted, it's a double-edged sword because I couldn't run Radio Memphis without a similar type system that I have been using now for quite some time. So, yeah, it does help out, but it does also alleviate having to have a jock in there necessarily all the time. It's always going to play the music. It's going to play the sweepers, the spots. It's not, all that stuff is just going to work. As a matter of fact, it can do this thing called voice tracking. Voice tracking has been around long enough that most of you will probably understand what it is, and you have probably been duped by it. It's when a DJ goes into a production studio and spends 10 minutes laying down all of his voice tracks, if you will, for his whole show that will be spread over 4 hours, and thus the jock can go on about his merry way for his life that night, but the show still is on the air, and it sounds like he's live. That, my friends, is the spawn of the devil. That's what really did a lot of damage to the industry early on, because it did, unfortunately, put a lot of good talent out on the beach, as it were, and out of a job. The beach, by the way, in the radio business basically means you're fucked. You don't want to be there. So I come in to tell a kind of a drunken Drake Hall about all of this and how everything was shaping up and how the radio industry is really going to change whether we like it or not. And you may not like it. You may not appreciate it. And we're going to have to figure out how to deal with this sort of thing because it's a monster. So we embraced it because we really didn't have much of a choice in it. And I became rather adept at working with the system to the point of learning its faults and its failures. I know it's not a perfect machine. As a matter of interest, when I was in Denver, the guys, the developers of the project said it was impossible to crash. And promptly within about an hour and a half, I crashed it. And I got yelled at for it. They said, why the hell did you do that? And I said, you told me that it couldn't be crashed. And I'm just telling you that there's going to be some waterhead DJ out there who's drunk and high, doesn't know what he's talking about, possibly tripping on acid. He's going to do something. He's going to crash the system. So now how are you going to fix it? So unfortunately, through what I had did, I made a better system for him by accident when I really should have gone the other way around and just let it crash. Interesting other side note, one night, one very early morning at Rock 103, the entire automation system completely shut off in the middle of a broadcast. The reason being, Clear Channel didn't pay the licensing fees that month. So no, it does require some type of human intervention, and it does request humans from time to time. Now, granted, it had 7 redundancy systems, which were all easily bypassed, and they were all kept in its own secure room that had its own air conditioning system with an alarm if it got too warm for it. It would call people, specifically engineers, if it didn't get what it needed. It was a thinking machine, and it was very scary to work around. And I didn't like it. A lot of guys didn't like it. It could do certain things, but it also had its limitations. And I'm sure since I've been away from it, they've made a lot of different changes too. And that's the nature of progress. So moving forward in time, still working with Drake and Zeke, I would often find myself in a position of being what is called the swinger. And the swinger is the guy that gets to fill in for everybody that's on vacation. Since I was a salaried employee, that meant no overtime. What prompted me to go into full-time, quite frankly, was the December before they made that decision. I had set a record within Clear Channel for the number of hours worked in a month, and that was during the month of December because everybody was taking time off at the end of the year. And since I don't really care about the holidays, I've always worked them. I don't care for Christmas. I don't care for New Year's or any of that nonsense. I mean, that's just one of those things that happens. My birthday is around the first of the year, and I don't really care about that either. But I always enjoyed being in the studio and working around that time. And so there it was. I was doing a lot of that. I was constantly working. And one of the things that I got to do was fill in the morning show. I started filling in for Bev Hart. Now, Bev did the news for the Wake Up Crew, which meant that every hour she would read some stuff off of the AP wire and would also contribute to the conversations between Tim Spencer, who was the anchor of the show, and John McCormack, also known as Bad Dog. Now, Bad Dog was 25 years in this market. He was very well loved and respected by many broadcasters and people across this listening area. He was a comedian, spent some time out in Los Angeles trying to make it work. Also worked for FedEx at the time, didn't work. He came back, was an investment banker, and he was doing some stand-up here in Memphis when he was discovered by Tim, because Tim asked him if he could do a good Muhammad Ali impression, of which he did, and he nailed it. In fact, it was so good he fooled Ferdy Pacheco on the phone. That was pretty intense. So John got the show, and his career took off. An infectious laugh. A large-hearted man, a very jovial individual, and always in the mood for a practical joke of one form or another, and knew how to cause a lot of trouble for a lot of people. He was a blast to work with. Tim was the operations manager at the time. Tim, very bull-nosed, short dude, had his issues, is a good way to put it, had somehow managed to survived cancer a couple of times. Good for him. Had about 6 feet of his colon taken out of him at one point. Or as John used to say, he's the only guy I know that had an asshole transplant and rejected him. It was kind of true. Tim didn't have much of a sense of humor aside from what was incredibly filthy. He liked to work blue. Howard Stern was becoming a thing, at least a bigger thing in syndicated radio, and it was Tim felt that it was important, at least as far as my estimation, that it was important for him to compete with that. John necessarily would, you know, he'd be a little tacky, but never work as blue. And there were some things that, some decisions that were made by Tim that a lot of people didn't like. Tim is a guy that knows, and Tim, if you are listening, thanks, buddy. But he ruined a lot of people's careers and upset a lot of people, pissed off a lot of people, to the point of when I would hear things being said that, by God, if I ever saw him in a dark alley, he'll never walk out to the other side. I fortunately didn't have that type of animosity toward the man. I'm going to have a lot more about Tim in episode 3 of this series, part 3, I should say. But Tim was the boss, and whatever Tim wanted, Tim did. And Tim controlled the music, which was a printed out list of songs. The CDs were on the wall, and we'd pull them, and we'd play them, and we'd just follow the list. You know, it was pretty basic stuff. But when the computers came in, all of that swapping and changing would go out the window, because they knew exactly what you played, when you played it, and who swapped it out. They knew every keystroke that you would make in that damn thing. There was a very amusing incident one night, about 2 months into my career there. It was a Saturday night, and somebody had called in and requested Jimi Hendrix's Room Full of Mirrors. I'll never forget that, because, first of all, it's a great tune. And second of all, I said, sure, why not? And I played it. And it was just like 11 o'clock on a Saturday night, and all of a sudden the hotline is ringing, and I pick it up, and it's Tim. And he said, what is this? I says, Jimi Hendrix. And he says, I know that. And I said, why the fuck did you call and ask me that? Why are you playing it? Because somebody requested it. And he said this was the first lesson in commercial radio, we don't take requests ever. You always say, it's coming up in a little while. Sure, I can get that on, but you never play it. It gets far worse as the whole concept of astroturfing became a thing, which I'll get to a little bit later on. So, at any rate, the Wake Up Crew, Tim, Bev, and Bad Dog, on the air for many, many a year, and a very successful show, had top numbers. They were complimented in the afternoons by Drake and Zeke. The radio station was very strong. Middays, by just a point of curiosity, was run by a lady by the name of Jennifer Reed. Jennifer's now in Pennsylvania. I think she's in Pennsylvania. She's in Philadelphia. I don't know. She's in Pittsburgh. She's in Poughkeepsie. I don't know where the hell she is, but she's not in the business anymore. I know that because she went to a station up there that ultimately went under and they blew her out, and it happens. She did come back to Memphis for a while, and this is sort of amusing, and she was looking to get on the air, and she looked at the contract that was offered her, and she realized that she would be giving them more than she would be actually taking, and she said no. So there went Jennifer back to wherever it is that she went back to. So everything's humming along. Things are going great. And now consolidation is the thing. And we are now moving to 2650 Thousand Oaks. Corporate hell. It would be the move that would destroy the industry in Memphis. Right after the move, Bruce Demps got a job offer in Atlanta, Georgia for Radio 1. Now remember, he was our general manager, and he left. Before doing so, Drake and Zeke had left as well. Now, what led to their leaving Rock 103 was actually quite simple. They wanted to take over Morning Drive. Tim wasn't going to have any part of that. Tim was going to do whatever it took to stay on the air. Tim was not going to be swayed by a stronger show in the afternoons. And to be honest with you, the morning show at that time, the Wake Up Crew, was starting to suffer a bit. Tim wasn't really caring as much. He phoned it in. He was constantly preoccupied with other things aside from the business at hand. Because when you're on the air and you're on a mic, your job is to run your mouth and make people laugh or smile at the very least. I know I fail at that, but at least I try. And John was reduced to being the guy that just laughed at his own jokes. And Bev trying to carry on as much as she could. And meanwhile, the three of them not caring so much for each other anymore, and the destruction of the family unit that was inside that show was telling. All shows have their lifespans that they do. 25 years is a hell of a long time for a show like the Wake Up Crew, and they did remarkably well. So Bruce leaves, goes to Radio 1, and is replaced by his general sales manager, a guy by the name of Timothy P. Davies. Tim Davies is kind of an enigma. As John would say it, and it's a phrase I've used from time and time again, to stand in his presence and look him into the eye and have a conversation with him was like staring into the eyes of a chicken. There was nothing on in there. He didn't get it. He was a salesman. At one point, he tried to come in and tell me how to do my job. According to the FCC, I had control over that control room. I threw him out. And I told him that I would talk to him when I got off the air, of which I did. Got yelled at, but, you know, hey, it was worth it. Got yelled at a bunch, and it was worth it every time. But I always had a stellar performance record, so they couldn't, you know, really get on my ass too much about it. Always showed up. In the 14 years I was there, I called in sick 3 days, all told. Took my vacation when I could. Gave up a lot of vacation time along the way, but only called in sick 3 days. Look, it's not like you're working out in the fields somewhere. You're not out in the sun all the time. You're sitting in an air-conditioned studio on your ass, running your mouth, doing other people's biddings and making sure that everybody else is taking care of their own job. It's not terribly difficult. So Tim Davies takes it over, and we are now at the point of moving ourselves into this new corporate nightmare over on the fourth floor at Thousand Oaks. And it began a very strange part of the trip. Now, first of all six stations are now under the same roof, something that hasn't happened before with these stations. And the transition, of course, was a bit weird, a bit awkward, because now you're dealing with people that you would normally, just by virtue of being apart from each other, not necessarily have that opportunity to talk to or work with. And, you know, and it went well. It did. I mean, it was awkward at first, but it did come together fairly well. Tim Davies was under the mandate at that point by corporate to really start increasing the bottom line of the station, because at this point, Clear Channel was becoming very, very greedy. They had bought station after station after station across the country. At one point in their peak, they owned 1,800 radio stations across this country, countless billboards from coast to coast, including Australia, London, and China, of all places, and really fancied themselves as being the end-all to be-all of radio. And quite frankly, they were. They honestly earned the reputation and the name of being called the Evil Empire because they were evil. I will get into that evil later. So Davies hires, he starts bringing in more salespeople. He brings them on as many as he can, 30, 40, 50 at a time. He wants to flood the streets of Memphis and the area with salespeople. Now, up until this point, salespeople, like when we were down on Beale Street, Sherry would pay a straight 15% commission across the board to all the salespeople. From my understanding, it may have been a little sliding scale, but it was good money. There were a couple of girls in there that were making $100,000 a year just selling time for Rock 103, and it was easier back in those days because it wasn't as political, it wasn't as messed up as it later turned out to be. But corporate being corporate, they got greedy. So they started cutting the commissions. They cut them in half. So they would pay 7% now. They would, that's for new business. Old business, if you renewed that, it could be 3-5%. Last I heard, it was like nearly 2%. It's ridiculous. But they would bring these people off the streets. They would go to car dealerships and they would pick their people and say, okay, why don't you come over here and you can make a shitload of money working for Clear Channel Radio. It's a commission-based deal. It's selling radio. It's not that hard. And they would put them through their own school. It was Clear Channel University. It was this online catastrophe thing. And it took about 3 months to get through it. And while you were doing that for those 3 months, if you were that unfortunate of a soul that went through that, you got to make a little bit of pay for you to do that. And it was actually pretty substantial. It was like close to $30,000 to sit there and go through that class 8 hours a day for 3 months until they taught you how to sell Clear Channel time. 9 times out of 10, the people that would go through that Clear Channel University would say, fuck you, and quit, take the money and run, and they would start all over again and thus be pissing away all this money. There was a time that there was a revolving door in that facility that went for a couple of years where you would see new faces every day and never the same ones twice, because they would come in and they'd realize what load of horseshit all this was, and they would walk away from it. And we were over there on the programming side of it, never really cared much about it, but it was still having to deal with this ridiculous amount of traffic that was coming through there. Tim Davies thought it was, he was doing the right thing by corporate standards. And as I get close to wrapping this up, because I want to save really the best for last, I can set the table with this. Tim Davies was there for quite some time. Tim Davies had to deal with the departure of Drake and Zeke. They didn't get the morning show, so they left. They took their 6 month non-compete. Zeke had a 3 month non-compete. Drake had a 6 month non-compete. And we were all waiting with anticipation of what they would come onto the air with. And lo and behold, they came out with the same show that I produced for them for 8 years. No change, no nothing. They were still using my bits. I think they still do them. I haven't listened to them in forever. And there's a reason for that too, which I'll get into next week. So Drake wanted me to ride out my non-compete, which was a six-month ride. He said he suggested to me that I go and get a dishwashing job for 6 months and then come over to 98, where they were at WXMX, and produce their show for them and make them number one again. At that very same time, a young comedian who was doing sports for them by the name of Dennis Phillippe. Dennis and I got to talking about the future of that afternoon show, and we decided we'd make a run at it. And we went to Tim Spencer and told him that we wanted to do it. And he said he would take it under advisement. Drake and Zeke left. We filled in. We were told to fill in for a while. So it was a live on-air audition for about 3 months. It was the longest 3 months of my life because we didn't know if we were going to get the job or not. Ultimately, it came down to a remote. It was at a TGI Fridays, I recall, I believe in South Haven. And we were there, Dennis and I, doing our show, the Dennis and Rick show. When Tim Davies showed up in his whole corporate thing, our producer at the time was this Hungarian lady by the name of Luca. Lovely, lovely lady. Unfortunate what happened to her as well. I took the blame for it, but that's what happens. I'll get to that later. Luca used to refer to Tim Davies as the guy with the childbearing hips, which I thought was hysterical. You'd have to know Davies. But anyway, he shows up at this TGI Fridays, and there's all these people. We had a huge draw. There was all these people there, and I'm sitting there at the broadcast table, and I'm wearing my sunglasses, and I've got the smoking jacket on. It was when I first started wearing those on stage, and just trying to give the audience something visual and doing what we do. And Tim comes in and on the air offers us a contract to stay on as the afternoon drive, complimentary to the wake-up crew. So the wake-up crew holding steady, all of a sudden after Dennis and I get on, the bottom begins to fall out. The station starts ripping apart at the seams. The whole corporation in Memphis really starts falling apart. My timing could not have been worse. It was the first of what they would call the Black Fridays. It was what they called, technically in corporate terms, they called it a reduction in force, an RIF, which meant that they were going through and they were going to start firing people, and they did. They fired a shitload of people. Across the country, 2,500 people lost their jobs that day for corporate greed. One of them, Bev Hart. She was part three of the wake-up crew. Here's what's really sick and fucked up about that. Tim Spencer knew he had to fire her, and he knew it for 10 days before he did it, and somehow managed to keep her on the air for 10 days without hinting that this was going to happen. That cold-hearted fuck is brutal. And that's when Dennis and I got called into the office after that big remote. And Davies said, we are going through reductions in force. Your contract will not show an increase. You're lucky to have a job. And if you're thinking about going to another radio station, specifically Cumulus, the new program director is no longer there, so you have no friends but me. That's the way it was put by Tim Davies. He's sitting there in his office with his feet on his desk and a pile of key cards next to his feet. It would be twice that I would see that. So we went on and did our job. Fortunately, Bruce was still around, actually. Bruce was, he actually literally got down on his knees and kissed my feet one time because of the numbers we were bringing in, which I thought was kind of cool. It was on his way out the door, but it was kind of cool how that happened. So that was that. Now, Dennis and I would hold down the afternoons for 3 years. And we had a time. We were the number one thing in that drive time from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. across the whole city, the whole listening area. We were the number one thing. We had a soda company called the Jones Soda Company that actually put Dennis and I on their label and created our own beverage for us. It's some really horribly fruity, fizzy thing, and it's nasty. But appreciate the sentiment nonetheless. We had a great time. And when the bottom began to fall out, it started with the guy that was seated to my left, and that was with Dennis.
Here's what's coming up on the next edition from Radioland.
Every great war story always seems to be told by a veteran who starts with the words, so there I was. There I was in the parking lot, and I pull into my parking space, and I see Dennis out there, and he's leaning up against his the hood of his car, and he's got his head down, and he's looking at his feet, and I get out and say, hey, what's up, man? And he said that they canceled our show. The Dennis and Rick show was no longer on the air. About 10:30, my phone rings, and it's John. And he says he's still in the hospital. And he says, well, I've got good news. And I said, well, what's that, John? And he says, I'm not having a heart attack. And I said, well, that's good. I said, what the hell's your problem? He says, I have leukemia. Before he died, he said that should I die, Rick, I need you to do me a favor. I need you to make me a promise. And you make sure that Tim Spencer and Michael Oppenheimer do not attend my funeral.
Radio Memphis is an internet broadcasting service provided by PirateRadioStudios.com, Memphis, Tennessee, USA.
So that's where we will pick up on the final episode next week of this series, this three-part series, Exiled to Radioland. It was tough. And the next episode that you will hear, you've already heard a couple of snippets of it, it was tough to produce. It was tough to think about because it's going to involve me walking through some old dark passages that I haven't been through in quite some time. These stories that I will relate to you will be the final words I have to say about it, pretty much publicly. I'm not going to write a book about it. I'm not going to do another episode of this on the subject. I might refer to those days in passing, hopefully with some comedic bit to it. I don't know that I can do that at all as we continue this and wrap that story up. I know many, many of you have been interested in hearing how this all played out. And the fact that out of everything that was horrible and everything that went down so badly, and let me tell you people something, it's going to make you sick. It's going to make you upset. It's going to make you angry. I'm not looking for sympathy. I don't want it. Neither do some of the people that made it through it. Just a simple understanding of what it was like to go through those days, which led to my end of the end of my terrestrial radio career. That's what's going to happen next time. So once again, thank you so much for being a part of the program. You can always do me a favor. If you like what you hear, please share this amongst your social media. We are found in many, many places. If you go to my blog at rickchatter.blogspot.com, you'll see a list of all the places where this podcast can be downloaded and put into your system. If you're not in iTunes, there's plenty of other places to get it as well. You can listen on your desktop at the Blogspot page. You can also download it there and keep it there. You can also find a way to stick it onto your phone if you're using an Android device. There's plenty of ways to hear it, and there's an app through TuneIn and everywhere else as well. So there you have it. Thank you again so much. We'll see you next time. My name is Rick Cheddar, and this has been From Radioland.